This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 29, 2005. Sitting in for Auda Bogado, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington, D.C. We get an update from Indonesia on the toll of an 8.5 earthquake. The Iraqi assembly is deadlocked over a new speaker, and a dangerous biolab could be built in a black neighborhood in Boston. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The bank that helped the former Chilean dictator launder money will pay one of the largest fines in U.S. history. Kelly Giddens reports from D.C.
The Washington, D.C.-based Riggs Bank has to pay a $16 million fine for helping former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet and the leaders of oil-rich Equatorial Guinea to hide and launder more than $700 million in secret United States bank accounts. Today, Judge Ricardo Urbina accepted the plea agreement between the U.S. Justice Department and the Washington-based bank, the largest in U.S. history. The bank pleaded guilty on January 27th for failing to report its illegal transactions for Pinochet and his family. In his ruling, Judge Urbina stated this morning, "There is no way of measuring the amount of harm and atrocities and human rights violations perpetrated by Pinochet and Equatorial Guinea as a result of the enabling criminal activity by Riggs Bank." He continued, "The bank now stands disclosed before this court as a greedy corporate henchman of dictators and their corrupt regimes," according to Urbina. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Kelly Giddens.
Canada's annual sea hunt begins today, and animal rights activists in 30 countries are protesting at Canadian embassies in a campaign launched by the Humane Society of the U.S. Kristen Schwartz has more from CKLN in Toronto.
The animal rights activists say that harvesting seals for their fur is barbaric, making their case with graphic photos of bloody baby seals. To pressure Canada to end the commercial seal hunt, they're calling for a boycott of Canadian seafood, a tactic first used in the 1980s when the Humane Society successfully campaigned to wipe out the market for sealskin. In 1983, the European Community banned the import of baby seal pelts. The ban had devastating impacts on Inuit communities and the people of economically depressed Newfoundland, both of whom were heavily dependent on the seal hunt. Since then, the seal population has grown rapidly, and demand for the pelts has also increased, making the seal hunt economically viable once again. In Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
The Lebanese political landscape is about to become less stable as the president resigns again. Mohamed Shublak reports from Beirut.
Lebanese Prime Minister Omar Karami is expected to resign tomorrow as he failed to persuade opposition leaders to join his effort to form a government of national unity. This will be the second time Karami will resign within a month. The first resignation followed massive pressure from the opposition after the killing of the former Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri in a car bomb 2 weeks earlier. He was reappointed by the Lebanese President Emil Lahoud on the 10th of March. Anti-Syria opposition leaders refused to join any government unless an international investigation into Hariri's assassination was assigned. Last week, Lebanon accepted the UN Security Council's decision to form an international commission of inquiry into the killing of Hariri. For Free Speech Radio News, Mohamed Shublak, Beirut, Lebanon.
A veteran Florida reporter is acknowledging that he has earned hundreds of thousands of dollars on the side from the government agencies he covered for the news. Mitch Perry has the story from WMNF in Tampa.
Mike Vasalinda has covered the Florida legislature from the state capital of Tallahassee for the last 30 years. His reports are aired on nearly every NBC affiliate in the state and occasionally on CNN. But it was reported last week that his production company has earned more than $100,000 over the past 4 years through contracts with Governor Jeb Bush's office, as well as the Secretary of State, the Department of Education, and other government agencies that Vasalinda covers on a regular basis. The only NBC-owned news station in Florida, WTBJ in Miami, says it will review the situation with Vasalinda and will not run any stories he produces until they have completed the review. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Daily demonstrations in Nepal show no sign of abating. Over 1,000 leaders and activists have been arrested since February 1st, when the king of the Hindu kingdom clamped down on virtually all freedoms. Radio stations have been stopped from broadcasting any news or current events, television stations have been barred from broadcasting any criticism of the government. Newspaper and print journalists are being intimidated, assaulted, and arrested. The South Asian Free Media Association demanded the immediate release of all journalists from detention and the restoration of freedom of the press. An 11-day general strike is being planned for April 2nd, and political parties have announced rallies and protests to coincide with the 15th anniversary of the mass action that forcibly seized power from the king's current father. Michael Vandeveer provided that report from Kathmandu. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today of a case that could have a major impact on the legality of sharing computer files. The case has the entertainment giant MGM accusing Grokster, an online file-sharing company, of being liable for when its users share copyrighted materials such as music and movie files. Selena Masuda, the D.C. Radio Co-op, was at the hearing, and she brings us this report.
It's a windy, chilly Tuesday morning in Washington, D.C. Outside the steps of the Supreme Court, over a couple hundred people formed two different circles. One circle of people chant support for Grokster, a peer-to-peer file-sharing software company that is being challenged by big entertainment companies and associations. The other circle is filled with songwriters, record, music, and television executives, as well as musicians chanting their concerns over what they call the theft of intellectual property by companies like Grokster.
What we're here to do today is to protect capitalism in its true form. You create some, you should be justly compensated, and that's the way the American life has been based on for the last 200 and something years.
According to record companies like MGM, they lose billions of dollars from illegal peer-to-peer file sharing, even though supporters of Grokster say that numerous artists have found success through the current format of peer-to-peer file sharing. For Fred Cannon, a senior government analyst of Broadcast Music Incorporated, or BMI, a performing rights organization, companies like Grokster keep artists from making a living off their work.
This goes far beyond music. It's about protecting creativity. And America's greatest source of income and for our economy is American creativity. It's always been the forefront throughout the world. And if that creativity is not compensated, there's no future for America.
Elliot Frutkin would disagree with Cannon. Frutkin's company, Time Tracks, filed an amicus brief with five other emerging technology companies supporting Grokster. Frutkin attended the Supreme Court hearing where Justices Anthony Kennedy, Antonin Scalia, and Stephen Breyer raised the notion that a Supreme Court decision in support of MGM could possibly hurt development of new companies.
They were trying to emphasize that there's going to be zero innovation in controversial spaces if the minute a company announces their new products, if they're immediately sued and basically put out of business before they can launch their product and launch their legitimate uses of their product.
Thad Anderson of OutragedModerates.com, a political blog, uses peer-to-peer file sharing to allow visitors of his site to download government documents. One of those documents include the 1984 decision on Sony versus Betamax, a case that relieves inventors of liability for the manner in which their product is used.
The Betamax case in 1984 was the big case that decided that VCRs were legal and that you could have VCRs in the home, even though it was obvious that some people were going to infringe, you know, by using VCRs. But what they decided was if there was a substantial non-infringing use of a technology, that had to outweigh the fact that there might be infringement.
Rick Carnes, president of the Songwriters Guild, came from Nashville, Tennessee. Carnes has been a professional songwriter for over 27 years. Carnes says that there is no comparison between the 1984 Betamax case and the case against Grokster.
The vast majority of the uses for the Sony Betamax were time shifting of television shows. That was perfectly legal. But the vast majority of uses for Grokster, over 90% is illegal downloading of copyrighted material. So this is two entirely different examples.
I think the way that this case has been oversimplified in the media in particular has been to say that it's about artists versus pirates.
That was Annalee Newitz, a policy analyst for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties group for higher technology.
This is about companies who make software available that some people use autonomously to engage in infringement. And so I think when people consider this case, what they should really be thinking about is, do we want an environment where companies, small companies, small entrepreneurs, have to hire a fleet of lawyers before they develop new kinds of applications for media technology.
The Supreme Court could have their decision by June. Selena Masuta, Free Speech Radio News in Washington.
Today, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan was cleared from involvement in the awarding of a $10 million a year contract under the Iraqi Oil for Food program to a company that his son, Kojo Annan, worked for. Still, the independent inquiry, led by former U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker, criticized Annan for not properly investigating potential conflicts of interest. Annan addressed reporters after the release of the report.
The member states of the United Nations and their peoples certainly have the right to expect from now on, we in the Secretariat will be more fully transparent in the way we carry out their mandates and their wishes, and that managers will be held clearly accountable for their performance.
The report did say that an assistant to Annan's chief of staff, who retired last December, shredded documents that related to the Oil for Food inquiry. The report also said that Annan's son deliberately deceived him about the matter. Annan said he would not step down as Secretary General, though some U.S. Republican lawmakers have called on him to do so. Pressure is building on the newly elected Iraqi Assembly for not yet having chosen a speaker to the body. Without a speaker, the Iraqi Assembly cannot move forward with its task of drawing up a new constitution. The two major parties in the Assembly, the Shiites United Iraqi Alliance and the Kurdish Coalition, indicated the desire to select an Iraqi Sunni to become speaker in an effort of inclusion which they hope would calm the Sunni-led resistance. But with other political ambitions, the two leading candidates, the current interim prime minister Iyad Alawi and the interim president Ghazi al-Yawar, saying they want to remain with the opposition party, thus leaving the Assembly scrambling to find another candidate. The Assembly will meet again this Sunday. Speaking from the Rose Garden at the White House, President Bush was optimistic that the Assembly would move forward.
We expect a new government will be chosen soon, and that the Assembly will vote to confirm it. We look forward to working with the government that emerges from this process. We're confident that this new government will be inclusive, will respect human rights, and will uphold fundamental freedoms for all Iraqis.
Now joining us by telephone from Baghdad is Khaled Jarrar, who writes an online blog about the U.S. presence in Iraq. Khaled Jarrar, thank you for joining us. President Bush was optimistic about the Iraqi Assembly now moving forward 2 months after the elections. How do you feel about it?
The truth is that people are very much disappointed. The ones that took the risk and went to vote actually risked their lives to go to vote, to leave their houses in the elections time. It was really dangerous. But even those who decided to go and vote feel that they've been betrayed now. It's been over 2 months now, and nothing, as in nothing at all, have been decided till now. And people who went to vote just were hoping that by voting they can accomplish something to get the security situation to be better in Baghdad, or to get the communication system, whatever. They were hoping that by voting they can make a government that would provide them with these things. But now after 2 months, they didn't do anything at all. And people are very disappointed in the street.
And so what do you think needs to happen next?
People in the street are saying, stop doing this. Stop arguing about the politicians, and just do something for Iraq people. Just do something important for us. We need somebody to take care of Iraq people.
It's been 2 years now since the military has entered Iraq. When do you think the Iraqis want the U.S. military to leave?
Well, the truth is that I believe that Iraq people can protect themselves. Before the invasion, before the Americans came, we have never, ever heard of something called a car bomb or a kidnapping or a bad security situation. This never happened. By being here, the Americans are actually making Iraq the heaven for terrorists from all around the world.
And how do you think the U.S. should leave?
Let me say, let all the parties in Iraq on the ground meet, talk, and agree on the basic things. That way they can make a government that Iraqi people would want and support, And that's not the case now. Now, so many people are attacking the government, the Iraqi police, and the National Guard because they feel that they're strangers, that they don't represent them. Once there is political agreement between all sides, the way that all the rights of all the sides, the minorities, and the major sectors of the Iraqi, and at that moment, it would be really easy to get the occupation out.
And that was Khaled Jarar. You can read his blogs at www.secretsinbaghdad.blogspot.org. So far, there have been over 330 confirmed deaths in Indonesia after yesterday's 8.5 earthquake. Officials still say the death toll could reach over 1,000. The quake was also felt in Malaysia, Thailand, and Singapore. The damage to electrical and telephone lines and airports are making evacuations difficult in the hardest-hit area of Sumatra. Still, hundreds of emergency aid teams from Indonesia and abroad have arrived at the island. From Jakarta, Indonesia, Maggie Margiono has more.
Monday's earthquakes destroyed some 80% of the buildings on Nias and Simelu Islands, and severe damage also occurred in other areas of Sumatra, including Aceh. Reports of the estimated death toll range from 300 to 3,000, depending on the agency. Indonesia's National Coordinating Agency for Disaster Management and Refugees stated that some 300 people had died on the islands, with hundreds of others injured. Wisnu Wijaya is with the agency.
We estimate the number of ruined buildings, the population affected, and the damage caused by the quakes. The quakes happened very late at night when people were sleeping. Damaged structures caused most of the deaths. Since people were asleep at home, the situation was very bad.
By airtime, hundreds of rescue teams were still evacuating people from collapsed structures. Since the strong quakes hit the region yesterday, local geological agencies report some 100 aftershocks hit Sumatra, some of them over 6 or 7 on the Richter scale. Aftershocks continue to hit the region, and although Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and Sri Lanka have all lowered the tsunami warning level, officials are still recommending that people stay far from coastal areas. Reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta, I'm Monica Lopez for Free Speech Radio News.
A vote scheduled for this week in Mexico's Congress may determine the fate of the country's next presidential election. The candidate favored to win the presidency in 2006, however, may be prevented from campaigning. In Oaxaca, Mexico, Shannon Young has the story.
Mexico City's popular mayor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is the frontrunner in the opinion polls regarding the outcome of Mexico's 2006 presidential elections. Although López Obrador is frequently referred to as a leftist, not all of his supporters fall into the same ideological category. For example, Oaxacan resident Benito Hernández voted for the right-wing Partido Acción Nacional, or PAN Party, in 2000.
We thought that the PAN was an option for government, but it's let us down and now we have to search for the best person who would be able to win the presidency. And in this case, we're thinking that the person could be Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
But there's something that may block López Obrador's access to the executive office, a process known as desafuero. In other words, removing the immunity from prosecution granted to politicians during their terms in office. Mexican politicians cannot run for office if they have charges pending against them, a situation only possible if an officeholder's fuero, or immunity from prosecution, is taken away by a congressional vote. The charges against López Obrador stem from a case of eminent domain. He used his authority as mayor of Mexico City to expropriate a tract of land for the purpose of building a direct route to a hospital. A judge later signed an order to abandon the hospital road project and to leave the private tract of land intact, but the construction began anyway. If Congress votes to remove López Obrador's immunity from prosecution, he could face a charge of contempt of court for ignoring the judicial order in the case of the hospital access road. He would therefore be unable to run for the presidency in 2006. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, speaking during a recent visit to Oaxaca City.
I'm saying once and for all, I will not appeal the case if the desafuero goes through. I will not seek freedom under bail. I will go to jail as part of the peaceful civil resistance. And from there, if things go that way, we will continue fighting. I will register myself to seek the PRD candidacy for the presidency of the republic.
The congressional vote on the desafuero issue is scheduled to take place on Wednesday. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
In February, India began its first AIDS vaccine trials on humans to prevent the spread of the disease. Though the event is being marked as historic in a country with a high HIV rate, some activists feel that there is little being done for the people currently carrying the virus. FSRN correspondent Benu Alex reports from Mumbai.
Last month, India joined the global initiative to fight the increasing AIDS crisis as it began its first AIDS vaccine trial at National AIDS Research Institute in the western city of Pune. And to get human volunteers for the trial, counselors are advising potential volunteers who may be apprehensive about the entire process. The vaccine is designed by Seattle-based Targeted Genetics Corporation and modeled after subtype C of HIV that accounts for most infections worldwide. The volunteers are in plenty, though the institute has refused to divulge their identities. However, some activist groups have raised some basic questions on the trials. They have sought to know whether the trial's effectiveness be maximized and the risk be minimized. Will the program move carefully to ensure that the vulnerable groups are not exploited? And also, how effective would the vaccine be by the time trials are completed, some 10 years from now? Dr. M.S. Menon is an AIDS counselor and a practicing doctor in Mumbai.
Are we looking to a vaccine which is meant for primary prevention, or are we looking for a vaccine which is going to improve or modify the outcomes of treatment? A single antigen-based vaccine will not work because of the strength of the virus to have so much potential to mutate and change its antigenic capacities. So by the time you develop a virus with a single antigen and get it approved for clinical trials and practice in the country, it is obsolete.
But some ethical problems, particularly in countries like India, where a higher estimated incidence of HIV permits smaller sample sizes and faster results, will always exist. But the principal investigator of the trial, Dr. Sanjay Mahanjali, does not think so.
Both screening and enrollment, there are written consent forms which are discussed with the would-be participant or the volunteer in great details. Any questions if the participants have? Basically, what we expect in this study, that the volunteers should be literate.
Though the figures are highly disputed, rough estimates indicate that India has more than 5 million people living with HIV, and experts say the number could quadruple by 2010. The World Bank has warned the disease would become the single largest cause of death in the world's second most populous country unless there is progress on prevention. Dr. M.S. Menon again.
We still have to work on the primary concepts of managing the epidemic, which is increased awareness, changes in stigmatization and discrimination. As a medical person, I understand that vaccine is one of the predominant and safe methods. Unfortunately, this is the requirement and the demand on populations that the medical groups and researchers have to keep working on this. We cannot give up.
India doesn't have a national security system to pay for cost of medicine. The country also doesn't have a medical insurance system covering HIV. The myths and the misconceptions on the transmission of virus still continue. And medical practitioners like Menon says these are not addressed before entering into vaccine trials. From Mumbai in India, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Boston University is planning to build a Level 4 biolab in the Roxbury neighborhood of the city. According to the National Institute of Health, biosafety Level 4 is required for work with dangerous and exotic agents that pose a high individual risk of infections and life-threatening disease. Critics have cried foul, claiming it is environmental racism to locate the facility in a predominantly black neighborhood. They also cite the university's poor safety record and its ability to handle deadly organisms like anthrax and Ebola. Some allegations even go further, saying that the proposed lab would also conduct bioweapons research. Though such plans are unconfirmed, much of the funding for this project comes from the Pentagon. Chuck Rosina has more from Boston.
Last night, the Boston City Council held an expedited meeting to look into the safety concerns at BU's biolab, as three scientists who work in the lab recently contracted tularemia, a serious illness caused by bacteria often found in rodents. The hearing room was packed to overflow capacity, with supporters and opponents alike. Those in favor of the lab at last night's hearing were mostly construction workers. They see the lab proposal as an employment issue. Joan Eckline, a community activist, disagrees.
They're trying to convince the white working men, carpenters, etc., that they're going to have jobs out of it. They're pitting white working men against the black community. It's deeply racist. It's a deep American tragedy, and it's extraordinarily dangerous. I am not opposed to research to find cures for viruses, but that's not what this lab is going to be about.
Mel King, a lifelong resident of the South End neighborhood that borders the proposed site, is a former state representative and current employee of MIT's Urban Planning Department. King says there's other ways to address the jobs issue.
We have a need for affordable housing. We could do that. You know what it is with the construction workers? They probably would have built the incinerators which killed the people in Germany because they were jobs. And this is, in my mind, pretty much the same thing. They're not worried about that. All they're saying is that we can have jobs. But they're being wagged by the moneyed interests at Boston University.
Rather than the ethical issues, the City Council chose to concentrate on the safety record and the report delivered by the Boston Public Health Commission. City Councilor Maura Hennigan is opposed to the lab. She is running for mayor against incumbent Thomas Menino, who is an ardent supporter of the lab.
Even prior to the tularemia outbreak, I had concerns, but I think focusing on this raises the level in a very, very important way that if they are not already able to operate what they presently have in a way that complies with the standards, that we therefore should be able to feel comfortable that BU could ever manage a level 4 biolab.
Dr. Anita Barry of the Boston Public Health Commission gave statistics of the rarity of tularemia in Massachusetts. Then she turned to BU.
On November 10, 2004, the Boston Public Health Commission was notified of three suspect tularemia cases, all BU lab workers. And that's when our investigation began. However, as of now, the source of the tularemia at Boston University remains unclear.
Further testimony revealed that it was human error that led to the lab workers' contamination. City Councilor Charles Yancey.
Okay, so what's the implication for other agents getting out into the environment if we don't know what they are? I mean, if that was Ebola, for example, being transported in a human error, based upon your testimony, Dr. Barry, you're not suggesting that this was any type of terroristic attack or anything intentional. So it was human error that created the problem. How are you comforted that human error could not recur again in the future?
I would never say there will never be human error.
In later testimony, BU's medical school provost, Thomas Moore, tried to defend his institution.
The Boston Public Health Commission has taken the stance, and I think we agree with it, that it's their job to figure out whether something is a risk or not. And even though they didn't disagree with our assessment that this did not represent a public health risk, we should have reported it on day one.
Boston University said they would abide by the new guidelines instituted by the Boston Public Health Report. But the issue of the biolab is far from settled and promises to be a major campaign point in the upcoming mayoral election. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Washington, I'm Mitch Jezerich.